Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part one of our program is in honor of tomorrow's running of the Kentucky Derby. I count it as a real pleasure the opportunity I had to speak with best-selling author Joe Drape about an absolutely fantastic book called Our Boys, a perfect season with the on the plains with the Smith Center Redmen, which followed the exploits of one of the most successful high school football dynasties in the whole country. Joe Drape relocated himself and his family to this small town in Kansas and followed the story of this extraordinary football team through yet another undefeated season. A terrific book, and I had a great time speaking with Joe Drape about it. And now we have the opportunity to speak once again about a very different sort of sport, but it's actually the sport with which he and I spoke the very first time when we spoke about a book of his called Black Maestro, The Epic Life of an American Legend, which told the story of an early black jockey, now largely forgotten. Well, nobody has forgotten American Pharoah, of course, that amazing horse that won the Triple Crown in such spectacular fashion. And Joe Drape has written what I'm sure will be regarded as the definitive account, not only of that extraordinary accomplishment, but also a very, very interesting background on the sport itself of thoroughbred horse racing. And he has some connection to it himself, has covered the sport extensively over the course of his long career as an award-winning sports writer for the New York Times. This book is called American Pharoah, The Untold Story of the Triple Crown Winner's Legendary Rise, published by Hatchett Books. And Joe Drape, we welcome you back to the Morning Show.
Greg, it's always good to talk to you. We have good conversations. And you just mentioned two of my favorite books, and this is another one of my favorite books. But you know, I kind of have twin passions. I have this Midwest high school football home values, and then I stumbled into this crazy, colorful world of horse racing and have had a ball in both milieus.
You know, when I read the author's note at the beginning of the book, I literally went back to read one paragraph again because I was sure I had read it wrong. You write, "Long before I wrote about racehorses, I owned them." And sure enough, that's exactly what you said. That's exactly what you meant. And so I you go on to say that in a sense this really helps you to maybe better understand some of the intricacies of the sport and some of the special pressures that come to bear.
Yeah, and it's true, Greg. I started my interest in horse racing came like a lot of people's. My father passed it on to me. We grew up in Kansas City, Missouri. Twice a year, he and my mom would either go to Axer Bend, which was in Omaha, or Hot Springs, Arkansas, at Oaklawn Park. The night before, he'd get the racing form, sit up with me, show me how to read it. When I came of age, we'd go together. And it just became something like working a crossword puzzle. I loved the atmosphere. I loved seeing these creatures in full flight. It became my golf in a way, and I was a news reporter, and I was traveling a lot. And whenever I'd be in a town, I'd look to see if a racetrack was near, and sure enough, if there was one, I'd know I'd go spend a little bit of the afternoon or the evening if they were running in the evening. And by last count, I'm about 127 tracks in 9 countries.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just something I like to do. And then that led to me, I stumbled into actually writing about horses. Way before that, you know, friends and I would pool our money and we bought a horse. We started with the quarter horses. My first one was O Desperado, which took me to garden spots like Salisaw, Oklahoma, and Leavenworth, Kansas, and it was fun. And then I moved into thoroughbreds, And, you know, five or six of us would throw it in, and they were decent horses. They weren't stakes horses. They weren't Triple Crown horses by any means. But when I got to the Times, I was the college football writer, and I was doing that a couple of years, and the horse racing writer, the turf writer, was retiring. And they knew that I knew a little bit about it. They said, here, fill in for a while. And now, 18 years later, I'm still doing it, among other things. And it does inform what I know. I do know the economic pressures. I know the temptation of the trainer saying, well, he's a little sore and probably could use some time off, but there's a race he fits that I think he can win. And, you know, I know that's a tough decision. He's costing you $110 a day. He's got vet bills. He's got feed bills. You know, he needs to run to earn. And that is what I think. And I've written quite extensively on the ugly of horse racing. And, you know, I've had series and have pushed through reforms, helped push through reforms. And I understand that. But it to me, is unforgivable. And, you know, this American Pharoah book is sort of the exorcism of me and my knowledge of horse racing, and it was a way to tell a triumphant story and to explain what horses mean to people and how they can change lives, but all the shoals you have to navigate, and some do it better than others.
Right. You really outline how it is a pressure-packed business and one that is immensely costly, and of course the risks are very, very high. And you also go on to mention that the recession in 2008 had really a devastating effect on the industry as a whole. So in a sense, as this story begins, it is what you term scary times for the industry. And I suppose in some respects that makes it an even more compelling story, that is the emergence of American Pharoah at a moment when horse racing really needed a feel-good story.
Well, the sport needed a feel-good story, and you got to remember, horse racing is an agribusiness. It's a $4 billion, 800,000 jobs across America. It's just not the jockey, rider, and groom. It's the people who shoe them, the farriers. It's the people in the feed store. It's the people at the farms in central Kentucky. And what happened in 2008 was very much like the subprime mortgages that sent all of us into the tank. People were spending more money for horses they really didn't need, and they were doing it on credit. And it was scary times, and we're still in it, and we're digging out of it. The full crop declined from 35,000 a year to 22,000. That shows you how many people had to go out of business. And at the time Ahmed Zayat entered this business, it was right about then. He was a flamboyant guy, and he owns American Pharoah. You know, his log line, as they say in movies, you can't make up. He was an Orthodox Jew from Egypt who made his fortune selling beer to Muslim countries. And, you know, that's the kind of endeavor and touch he had. He was passionate. He does things in a big way, including gambling. He bets 200,000 grand a week on horses. He got overextended along with a lot of people. You know, farms were getting foreclosed on down in Kentucky. He wasn't paying his bills. The bank in Kentucky, he borrowed $34 million, wasn't paying him. They called in the loans. So that's where he was in March in 2011. He was a guy who was in bankruptcy, who needed money, and he had this sire, Little Pioneer of the Nile, who had finished second in the Kentucky Derby, and this mare, Little Princess Emma, who had run twice but was bred very well, didn't win anything. They meet for a 30-second assignation with four guys choreographing it with them in flak jackets and helmets, one with a test tube to catch the semen to make sure the act was consummated, because there's so much money at stake. And again, that's into the agribusiness of it. And, you know, nobody knew. And it happens. It's happening right now. Down in Kentucky, they're breeding horses, hoping that they're an American Pharoah. But the vast majority of them just become horses that run around racetracks.
Yeah, it is a business that is to some extent scientific, and yet there's no way to be absolutely certain. At one point, somebody you interview says, pedigree is really a set of variables used to predict the probability of what you'll get before the horse is born. But once the horse is born, who knows what other factors can enter into the story. Something else we should mention about American Pharoah is that the man you just mentioned, Ahmed Zayat, nearly sold him. And it's partly because of the intervention of someone said who told him, sell your house, don't sell this horse, that he actually held on to him.
Yeah, and you know, that's the fascinating thing about the whole story is when I covered it in real time for the Times, and then I thought, this is too good, and I'm going to go back and re-report it. And you discover just the magic and the decisions and what looked like was bad fortune ended up being good fortune and how it changed all these lives. Mr. Zayat was still in money trouble. He needed to pay the last $14 million off when it was a time for American Pharoah. And he knew it was a well-bred horse. He looked great, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. He's truly a well-made, incredibly engineered horse. That's why he's as great as he is. But he needed the money. His advisor, you just quoted, is Jeff Sader. He's a guy who has all kinds of PhDs and patents on all these instruments that he can literally go to a horse, look down, measure its heart, run sonograms and ultrasounds, measure their spleen, check their airways. And this was the best specimen he had ever come across in 30 years of doing this and in a database with like over 300,000 horses. And he said, you know, we usually buy horses like this, don't sell them. He didn't listen. He ships them up to Saratoga. On the way, American Pharoah, and at this point he's only called the Little Princess Emma colt. He doesn't have a name yet. They're not named till they're two-year-olds. Somehow bangs an ankle. They think it happened in the van. He gets off, got a swollen ankle, a cut, looks terrible. Everybody at the sale, scared away from him, says, you know, no way I'm paying any money for that horse. Goes through the ring anyway. Bidden just stopped and started. So, you know, Zaya thought, geez, I just lost again. I got to take this horse back. And, you know, there but the grace of God goes the Triple Crown winner into somebody else's barn.
We're speaking with Joe Drape about his book, American Pharoah, The Untold Story of the Triple Crown Winner's Legendary Rise. So all is in place in terms of the pedigree of this horse. He came from great stock. He's a magnificent physical specimen, but he needs to be trained. And I think one of the most interesting things about your book is the way you help us understand the process of training a horse to be a racer. You write it that teaching a horse to race is a painstaking step-by-step process. And a guy by the name of Bob Baffert is the person who is most responsible for the training of American Pharoah. Just tell our listeners a little bit about this painstaking process, which most of us don't know anything about.
You know, it's years in coming, and Bob Baffert gets a somewhat finished product. A woman named Frances Relihan, an Irish horsewoman in Kentucky, she gets him when he's a weanling. So they're trying to get him away from his mother. His mother at that point is producing 40 pounds of milk a day, and he's growing at 40 pounds a day. And the reason they take him off is because they got to slow down the growth and let it become natural. So she gets him in a weanling. First, she has to teach him how to get familiar with other people, to know other horses, to be led around by a shank, to go in and out of a stall. You know, simple, painstaking things takes months. Then he goes down to a breaking farm. In a breaking farm, they first need to teach him how to run a little bit, jog. They run alongside him. They're on a horseback. They got the shank. They teach him to run in controlled fashion. Then they got to put some weight on him, and you just can't jump on the back of a horse. First, they put 20 pounds on his back, then 40 pounds. And these are all weeks and months. This doesn't happen over the course of a day. Then you put a guy, they call sandbagging him, you put him over the top of him. you just lean on him and just sit there for a while. And they let him stand there with it. Then you get on his back and just sit there. So, you know, all this stuff goes on. Then you have to teach him how to change leads. And this is something, if you watch the races this week, and the casual fan doesn't notice it, and I didn't notice it for a long time. They change what they call change leads. They lead with their left foot, their inside foot, when they're going around a turn, and when they come out of a turn, they switch leads to the right stride leads. Is that making sense to you, Greg?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And that gives them the extra power. You know, that takes months to teach a horse how to do that. So then they could show up at Bob Baffert. Okay, Bob Baffert is a Hall of Fame trainer. He's had tremendous success in the Triple Crown, won the Derby 4 times now. But at the time he shows up, you have Zayat. He's got his money problems. Bob Baffert's in a terrible slump. He's not really hit the board much in the Triple Crown for a decade. He's had personal problems on the racetrack. Horses in his care suddenly died. There's rumors and whispers what he's doing. He goes to Dubai, has a heart attack, nearly dies in a Mideast country for a big race. You know, it's a total come to Jesus moment. His parents die. He's got an 11-year-old kid. You know, he's reexamining his life and trying to bring some sense and balance into it. And he gets this horse. And this horse, he knows, is very talented. In fact, he thinks, boy, this may be the one. This may be the best one I ever had. So he works him for months. And again, first you walk him around the barn at that point with the saddle. Then you take him out. You let him run an eighth of a mile. Then you go 6 days later, another eighth. In all, he had about 60 workouts before he ever went to the racetrack on that. They do it every 6 or 7 days. Goes to the racetrack the first time. Martin Garcia is his go-to rider. He gets on him. He's acting up in the paddock. He's sweaty. He's, like, unfocused. He's running around, you know, bucking and jerking. Gates open. He runs off. Martin Garcia can't control him. They lose, and he finishes fourth. And Garcia comes back and says, boss, you know, I don't think I fit this horse. Back to the drawing board. This was what he thought was his best two-year-old. He figures out American Pharoah's got rabbit ears. He doesn't like noise. So he gets next race, he says, okay, I'm going to put some big old cotton balls in his ear. Something just that simple. And that's something you learn over 30 years of training horses. Martin Garcia's off. He's looking for another rider. And this is where Victor Espinoza enters the story. Victor Espinoza was his fifth choice. He first went to Gary Stevens, who's going to ride more spirit for him in this Derby Saturday. Gary Stevens is an old guy like me. I shouldn't say it that way. He's an older guy like me, and he's going to get his knees replaced. Mike Smith, another Hall of Famer, he's not available. Rafael Barrano, another guy Baffert rides regularly, he's not available. Victor Espinoza had some success in 2002 with War Emblem, went in two-thirds of the Triple Crown. Hadn't really ridden them much. It happens. Guys kind of fall in and out of favor by no fault of their own. Maybe they win some for a while, and then they don't win, and you just shake it up. But Baffert remembers War Emblem was kind of a tough horse to handle. In fact, he said he was kind of mean, and somehow Victor got along with him. That pops into his mind. He calls and says, you know, I think I got one for you. Victor gets on this horse, you know, as an afterthought. They win by 6 the first time. Victor hops off, calls his agent, says, man, this is a rocket ship. We got to keep this mount. This is our Derby horse. And then, you know, 7 races later, they're in the record books. And these are all, you know, these are all things nobody could count on.
Right, absolutely. I'm so glad that you talk as much as you do about Victor Espinoza. He has such interesting things to say about what he does. And again, I think most of us have just the vaguest notion of what a jockey does. And I think most of us make the mistake of vastly, grossly oversimplifying their role in this. I mean, I think we just see a diminutive guy sitting on top of a horse and just making sure it doesn't steer off course. But there are so many subtleties involved in what they do. And Mr. Espinoza seems to have some fascinating practices. Among them, that you tell us he is a rider who rides on instinct, a rider who lets the horse tell him how he should be ridden. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit? Because I just think it's such an interesting concept.
No, and it is. And what people forget about jockeys, besides being athletes, everybody knows they're great athletes, but they're truly horsemen. The most important thing they do, and often they only have 10 or 20 seconds to do it, is they got to make a friend and get along with the horse and be able to communicate to the horse. They're riding 9 races a day, so they're getting on one, getting on the next one. Some of them have different regimens. Some are read the racing form, try to figure out the way the race is going to run, the flow of the race, who's going to be in front, who's going to be in back. Some study other jockeys, learn their tendencies, because you're competing against the same guys mostly all the time. Victor was a guy who takes naps in the afternoon, and he truly can, he's half horse, he can communicate with the horse. So he knows by his hands, and there's so much done through their hands. I mean, everybody, and I'm not talking about the whip, everybody thinks about, okay, you got to tuck, you got to just sit there as a passenger. The hands are the ones that move the bit around in the mouth and make the horse comfortable and relaxes them and tells them to, you know, run into it this way, run into it that way. Victor gets on a horse and he's going to let the horse tell him how he wants to run. And by that, he means he's just sitting there for a minute. The horse, if the horse wants to go, he's going to let him go. And then he will react to that. He will get the horse relaxed. You know, a horse, a thoroughbred at least, has 1/8 of a mile burst where he can sustain his top speed. And that's where you're trying to do as a rider. You're trying to get him in the right position when you unleash that 1/8 of a mile kick, that it's going to put him into position to win. In some cases, American Pharoah was one of these for a long time when Victor first got on him. He was the one who could go out to the front and then mid-race go 1/8 of a mile knowing they can never catch him. And that's when he did. Others come from behind. You nurse them, you relax them, and then you unleash it in the stretch. Victor, over the course of riding American Pharoah, learned much about him. And he did 2 or 3 smart things that I think and he thinks won the Triple Crown. The first was 3 weeks before the Derby in Arkansas. He decided to take American Pharoah back, and that means relax him and run behind horses. Up until that point, he had won from the front, played catch me if you can in every race. Victor holds him back a little bit. Baffert's watching in California and thinks, what's wrong with the horse? There's something wrong with the horse. Victor sitting there knowing, okay, he needs to learn that in Kentucky there's going to be 20 horses. There's going to be a lot of speed. It's mayhem in the beginning. He's going to get knocked around. He needs to feel a little trouble and learn to relax and be able to overcome it. And he says, you know, if I get him beat at the Arkansas Derby, it's better to get beat there than it is in Kentucky. He goes through that strategy. American Pharoah relaxes beautifully. At the end, is able to kick away. He's fine. It's an important lesson. And sure enough, in the Derby, that's exactly what happened. The horse got banged around early, was behind horses. He could have been uncomfortable, but he wasn't. Got him to relax. Dueled with Dortmund, his stablemate, for a mile, put that one away, turns for home, and then Firing Line, another very good horse from California, comes, and they have an incredible stretch duel, you know, almost 200-300 yards, neck and neck. At one point, Firing Line passes him. Victor switches hands, and, you know, he took some heat from it. He switches from his left to his right and starts hitting him, and it's humanely, there are rules for it, but he went to his whip 30 times, and it didn't look good. But what he had done was switch hands, switch the horse's leads, and got him motivated and his head back into racing. And he made him get in touch with his competitive fire. And sure enough, he won it, and it was the only hard race in his career. It was one that it looked like he was going to lose, But, you know, the two things Victor did, teaching him how to relax early and then asking him for all he got late, is the one that got him through. And we all know if you don't win the Derby, there's no Triple Crown.
Right. That's where it all begins. And, of course, you're spelling out what a mental exercise this is, as well as physical, and not just mental for the jockey in terms of decisions being made, but in a sense a very much a mental exercise for the horse themselves, a mental and emotional exercise. Back to Mr. Baffert for a moment, the man most responsible for the training of American Pharoah. I was especially fascinated at the mention you made, and I don't remember before when you were talking if this got mentioned, that he is responsible for a couple of innovations, and one of them, he pioneered the use of two-way radio for something called breezes. I'd like you to explain that term and explain how he would use this two-way radio in the training process when, in your words, he came the closest to actually riding American Pharoah himself.
Right. He is an innovative guy. And let's just start to work out a horse. When they're in season, when they're campaigning, when they're racing, they breeze is the way for saying a timed hard workout. They do that. He likes to do it every 6 or 7 days. They go to the track every day and will gallop or jog a mile or a mile and a half, get out, stretch their legs. But when it's breeze time, he wires his rider, in this case Martin Garcia, all of his exercise riders, puts a headset on him. He's got a two-way radio. He's a former jockey, admittedly a bad one. And he likes to control. He can tell by the way they're moving if they need to go faster. He's got a good clock in his head if they're moving easily. And he can call an audible that way. He may go out, he may start out and say, Martin, let's go 5 furlongs and gallop out a 7 furlong. And then he watches and he'll see the American Pharoah's not really into it. He's not working that hard. So we're switching out. Now let's go 7 furlongs. And gallop a mile. At the same thing, Martin can tell him, he can go back to him and say, okay, he's a little edgy on the right, he's a little sore here, he's a little sore there. So it's just this intricate dance, so he can feel like he's on the horse and what the horse may need.
Fascinating. One thing I don't think we have exactly spelled out is the what an immense accomplishment it is for a horse to win the Triple Crown. I mean, I think we have a sense that it must be difficult because it happens so seldom through the course of sports history. But I think you do a really good job of explaining it, just exactly why that is, why, in fact, this is such an elusive achievement. Even apart from what we've already talked about, which is that the whole business of thoroughbred horse racing is rife with all sorts of different sort of challenges and intangibles. But what is specifically difficult about the gauntlet of the Triple Crown, especially the way it is laid out on the calendar?
Well, you start with that these are athletes who are just coming into their peak. They're more adolescents than full-grown men, in a sense. They're three-year-old colts. They're all maturing at a different time. You're asking them to run the furthest distance they have in their life so far, and will ever. The Belmont's a mile and a half. They'll only run that far once, and that'll be in the Belmont Stakes. You're asking them to do it in 5 weeks at three different tracks in three different cities. That means shipping them, flying them there, fanning them there. It means taking them out of their routine and resettling them. You know, Baffert is old school horseman. You know, he grew up very hands-on, just like a mechanic would grow up changing engines out of the car. He's always had hands on them. And here, tell you the most important thing he does is he kind of runs his shed row, which is his, like a hospital. You got to have them happy and healthy. You don't want to upset their routine. So you have all those intangibles to go. Then you just need luck. In the old days, when you had more in the 70s with Secretariat affirmed in Seattle SLU, those guys were owned by sportsmen and old families, and they bred to race. And if they didn't think their horse was good enough to run in the Derby or the Preakness, they didn't put them in there. So those horses beat the same good ones in fields of 6, 7, and 8. There weren't 20 horses every time at the Derby like there is now. They're in 14 at the Preakness like there is now. They're in 12 at the Belmont. And the reason the horses are fuller fields, you got guys trying to make money on the horse, A, by racing them, B, by proving their value, by winning one of these big races as a stallion and get them to the breeding shed. And see, some are owned by syndicates, like groups of people, and it's good advertisement to have, you know, your syndicate represented in these big races. So you get bigger fields, some of them, many of them, who are with horses that don't belong. Then you have guys who hold back their horses for the second and third leg. So, you know, after the Derby, only the Derby winner has to go to the Preakness, and that's why you get so many 2 out of 3. The ones who run well in the Derby say, hey, you didn't win in the Preakness, is that big a deal to come back in 2 weeks? I'm going to give my horse 5 weeks of rest and try to get him in the Belmont. So you have all these new shooters coming in at the end. Very good horses, not only the ones who had ran well early in the Derby, but ones who are maturing late, late developers, weren't on schedule to make the Triple Crown preps and the Triple Crown. So, you know, it's a hard thing to navigate. It's just been getting the competition's fiercer, the atmosphere is different, and it just, there's a reason there's only been 12 of them in 200 years.
One last question. I mean, I think we already have a real sense that this is a tremendously positive story, a real feel-good story in so many respects, especially the more we learn about this amazing horse, American Pharoah. But you do write at one point about the horse racing industry as a whole, that it's a difficult world. And you write at one point, horse racing is an insular world inhabited by hyper-competitive, rich people possessing massive egos who want the limelight for themselves. And you say other things about the horse racing industry that make it seem like, in some respects at least, not the most pleasant place to be, and populated with people who are maybe not the most pleasant to interact with. You obviously love this world nevertheless and were excited about this assignment. What did it feel like to dig deep into the world of horse racing and to have to encounter people that you've just described this way and write about them honestly and frankly and yet respectfully? I mean, I think that had to be kind of an interesting challenge as you put this book together and as you sought to tell this story the best way you could.
You know, it's more of an evolution than a challenge. I had the good fortune of being around it for 18 years and coming across this stuff with bright eyes and wide eyes and writing quite critically about some of the practices of it. In 2012, I was part of a series. I led a series that went into the doping of horses, why there were so many fatal breakdowns, some of the best bad practices, the fact that casino racetracks have boosted purses so much that, you know, low-level horses can run for too much money, and it tempted trainers, and they failed to resist the temptation to run sore horses just to get the money. They weren't taking the athletes in best interest first. So, you know, I have come across this. I do this for a living. I'm a journalist, and it's like somebody in politics will tell you the same thing. Somebody at City Hall will tell you the same thing. You're professional. You're respectful. You got to ask the hard questions. I mean, I've been cussed up and down by Mr. Zayat. I've been offered a warm handshake by him. It's part of the job, you know, and I'm old school to where if you write critically of somebody, you show up the next day, you take their phone call, you listen to their complaints. You know, you just try to be fair and accurate. That's all you're aiming for. So that's one aspect of it, and you can't look the blind eye on this. And this is what, in my view, this is what makes American Pharoah even more extraordinary to, you know, emerge out of this murky world where everybody's trying to get an edge, and it is competitive. These are Wall Street guys. These are entrepreneurs. These are tech guys. They're used to winning, and they're used to winning the way they want to win. Second of all, though, that makes it incredibly colorful, Greg. I mean, there's never a dull moment talking to these folks. And, you know, I've learned over the years, and this is about all people, everybody has a story they want to tell. And if you're just quiet and listen enough to them, it's going to tumble out, whether you want to hear it or not. And usually they're very interesting. So it's a world that is fascinating, that always has been. I mean, think Guys and Dolls. You know, it's never had a reputation as being for church women. So, you know, you kind of, you embrace it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, but at the same time, it's a beautiful sport, and there's a lot of great people involved in it.
Right. I guess I was really struck by the contrast between, for instance, the story you told in Our Boys, which is set in the heart of America, in the middle of Kansas, a real sort of bread and butter sort of story with lovely Midwestern people who it could not be more different from kind of the driven characters, although there's its own sort of darkness and pressures that are part of the world that you told us about in this small town in Kansas. I guess at the end, as much as anything, what we find so compelling is excellence and the quest for excellence. And maybe this is a way of understanding that there are so many paths to excellence, and that in and of itself can be a really interesting story.
Absolutely, Greg, and I'm going to steal that from you, that we're interested in excellence. That's a good way to put it. And I will add to that, you know, great achievements more often come out of flawed circumstances and characters. And, you know, that's the story of America, too. I really believe that, you know, we aren't an ideal country, but we strive to be. And sometimes we're good at it. Sometimes we're our best selves. More often than not, we're our worst selves. But, you know, you keep trying, and that's what the human condition is all about, is you got to get up the next day and try to do better than you did the last day. That's I still use that, and you remember it from Our Boys. Coach Barta, you know, that was his one creed, his one motto, try to be better than you were yesterday. Mm. And that you do that by just working harder at it. So, yeah, it's an interesting dichotomy, but you're right. We celebrate excellence, and excellence is attained different ways.
Absolutely. And I still remember trainer Bob Baffert's line. I think it maybe came right after the Kentucky Derby, when he said, and he's talking about American Pharoah, he's the one that won. It wasn't me. It was the horse. We were passengers.
And that's true. And that's what Bob, that's what I give credit on his evolution on this journey. And he told me near the end of it, he said, you know, 20 years ago, I would have gotten this horse and screwed it up. He goes, I was at the right place mentally and experience and my instincts. I knew what to do with this horse. I wouldn't have done it maybe 2 years ago. And, you know, that's a powerful statement to make.
The book again is American Pharoah, the untold story of the Triple Crown winner's legendary rise, and the author, Joe Drape. Joe Drape, you've done it again with yet another wonderful book. And thank you so much for joining me today on the morning show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Greg, always a pleasure chatting.
You're listening to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and here's part two, something from the Morning Show archives. We spend this portion of the Morning Show talking about the life of one of the finest sportscasters in the country, Al Michaels. We're talking with L. John Wertheim, from Sports Illustrated, who is the collaborator with Al Michaels on this memoir called You Can't Make This Up, Miracles, Memories, and the Perfect Marriage of Sports and Television. I spoke with L. John Wertheim most recently about his marvelous book, Strokes of Genius, which followed the twin paths of two of tennis's greatest geniuses, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal. Again, this book by Al Michaels, You Can't Make This Up. L. John Wertheim, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you.
So can you say a quick word about how you exactly collaborated with Al Michaels on this memoir? I mean, who wrote what, or how did you work together?
It's a good question. I'd never done a book like this before, where it's a collaboration, and yet you want to capture the voice of the subject, in this case, Al Michaels. So basically, we did a lot of talking and a lot of conversation. Al, you can imagine, very easy guy to talk to, has this wealth of stories, and then it basically was my job to structure this in book form. So I've had colleagues who have written books like this with athletes, and they said, oh, you know, this guy's 23 years old, and it's hard to get him to talk, and how am I going to get a book out of this? He hasn't done enough living. That was not an issue I faced. This was this was a lot of fun. This was probably a case of having so much material and editing and pairing rather than stretching words.
I imagine, given who you are and the work that you do, that to some extent you already knew Al Michaels. How well did you know him before this project began?
Yeah, honestly, not that. I mean, we were acquaintances, and I mean, kind of person you'd run into at a game every now and then and say hi. But you know, we weren't, you know, close friends or anything like that. And I think in a way that sort of helped, that I certainly knew Al Michaels, but I didn't know chapter and verse, and he knew me, but not, you know, again, with assumption that we had a ton of overlap. And so it allowed us to sort of start fresh. And it was a much different exercise from a process standpoint than any other book I had written. But it was great. Really, I think we were both real happy with how it worked out.
I think one of the things that I especially appreciate about the book is that, in addition to hearing all kinds of really incredible stories about the Miracle on Ice in Lake Placid in 1980 and other memorable moments, we learn a lot about how the world of sports and sports on television has changed so drastically over the years. And one of the themes which comes up very often in the early part of the book is how Al Michaels came to prominence at a time which seems now so antiquated in terms of technology. And some of what he and his colleagues were forced to accomplish was especially difficult given the technological limitations of the day. Can you maybe talk about one or two examples of what I'm talking about? I think it's a very, very interesting part of this story.
No, I mean, first, I appreciate you saying that. I mean, I think the best biographies and autobiographies have some deeper theme than just this compendium of stories and anecdotes, so I appreciate that. And yeah, that was something we tried to stress, that sports media has really changed a lot. Some of it's technology, some of it is just sort of our appetite, some of it's the money, and Al's been there the whole time. But you listen to some of his stories in the early going, whether it's, you know, the minor league baseball games, or even, you know, the Miracle on Ice game was on tape delay. I mean, people remember that game, and it wasn't even live. The outcome had already been decided. I mean, imagine that today. An event of that magnitude, U.S., Soviet, this underdog team, the Olympics. Imagine viewers not getting that in real time and not knowing the result, whether it was through Twitter or the crawl at the bottom of the screen or some other form of social media, when they tuned in. And, you know, some of this is just transmission. Some of this is, you know, ESPN did not exist when Al started his career. It's funny because as much as sports has changed, and you know, whoever thought we'd have devices in our pockets that would double as phones and cameras and ways to watch clips when we're on airplanes, Al would also tell you that what he ultimately does for a job hasn't changed a whole lot in 40 years. That the distribution has, and the method has, and the speed has, but basically, his job on Sunday nights isn't a whole lot different than what it was when his career was starting in the late 60s.
Hmm. I also appreciate how Al Michaels obviously has a marvelous grasp by now of how the work that he does has to vary from sport to sport, and not just because you're talking about a different sport, but with its own particular rules and so on, but that also pacing and rhythm and nuance is so different sport to sport. It specifically comes up at one point when he's talking about Ken Dryden, who was his broadcasting partner for that Miracle on Ice occasion. But he mentions in passing about, for instance, the drastic difference between being an on-air analyst during a hockey game versus during a football game. And it's not just that the rules of the game are different because the games are different, but the tools at your disposal and the means by which you're going to offer analysis, it's a completely different thing.
You know, that's a completely different thing. And the other thing that really struck me doing this book is that at one point, for kicks, we just started to count them up. And Al's had more than 100 partners. And what he has to do to work in conjunction with, you know, John Madden is totally different than what it is when he's working with, you know, just picking a Dennis Miller or Eric Dickerson or Bruce Jenner. And I think that there's a lot of versatility in games, and I think you're right. I mean, the rhythms and the cadences and sort of knowing when to let the action go. I mean, calling a baseball game is much different than calling a basketball game or calling a football game. But I also think Al has a real versatility in working alongside so many different people at so many different points in their career. Some of them were just novices. You know, Tommy Lasorda, who was managing 48 hours ago and suddenly he's in the booth, versus working alongside a guy like John Madden is a totally different exercise. And I think that Al's versatility also extends to how well he adapts to his partners.
Absolutely. Something else he talks about one point, and maybe it's because I'm also a voice teacher, it kind of grabbed my attention when he said this, is he mentions at one point continuously working, and particularly as a young announcer, on perfecting on how to use his voice as an instrument. Wanting to match the crowd. You don't want to be shouting while the crowd is quiet. You don't want to be whispering when the crowd is screaming. I always want to be in sync with the action. That's the kind of rather subtle, basic point that nevertheless I think is probably lost on the rest of us. But what a huge difference it makes if you aren't sensitive to something like that.
Yeah, I agree. And I think not unlike being a referee, being a sports announcer is one of those jobs that, you know, I'm as guilty as anyone. We all sit at home and you say, I could do that. Or how come he's not mentioning the penalty that they got in the first half? And it's one of these games, it's one of these jobs that invites second guessing. And we all love and are passionate about sports. And it's one of these things that I think a lot of people say, I could do that. There's a lot that goes into it. And some of it is in the preparation and the getting the pronunciation of names right, but a lot of it is more nuanced. And the passage you just read, I think, really illustrates that. There's a lot that goes on that these guys think about, and there's also a lot that they don't think about that just after so many years hopefully comes naturally.
Right, and he says at one point on television, often less is more. I want to finish by mentioning that I think Al Michaels in this book does a wonderful job of speaking honestly and frankly and perceptively about the wide range of people with whom he's worked, some of whom he's not particularly fond of, and he's open about their faults, and yet this book also feels relatively kind and relatively respectful, and that seems like a tricky balancing act. I mean, he could be very cautious about other people's feelings, and the book would end up being pretty bland, and on the other hand, he seems like a nice enough person that does not go out of his way to be unkind about other people and their weaknesses and foibles and flaws. Could you just say a word about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that also is sort of that's who he is. I mean, I think his instinct is to like people and give them the benefit of the doubt. I think most people he's worked with he's liked and vice versa, but not everyone. And I think he knew for this book to be authentic, he didn't have to settle old scores, and he didn't have to bury people. But, you know, when someone, you know, Boomer Esiason, to pick a name, when there were people that he didn't particularly care for, that wasn't something that he was gonna conceal. So, no, I mean, I think some people have read it, and they sort of said, you know, I wish it were more of a tell-all, and doesn't Al dislike more people? And I don't think that's the case. But also, as you say, it can't all be rainbows and balloons.
No, so we hear some frank talk about Rune Arledge and Howard Cosell and Pete Rose and many other fascinating people with whom he's worked or covered in this amazing career. The book, again, is You Can't Make This Up. L. John Wertheim, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. That was fun.
And the time is 8:59 here on WGTD. We have some interesting morning shows to talk about next week, beginning on Monday, when we will welcome into our studios Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College, who will be paying his monthly visit to the program. On Tuesday, we will be previewing for you a production that is coming up at the Racine Theater Guild, one of the most beloved and poignant and powerful musicals to be composed in the last half century, Fiddler on the Roof by Sheldon Harnick. We'll be talking to Doug Instanis and to a couple of the lead performers, including